jazz.
Hey, welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 208.5. I'm Pat. Mike has been traveling, and with the holidays, we decided I'd do a 0.5 episode to bridge between seasons 8 and 9 while he gets himself from the Midwest back to the West Coast. So our regularly scheduled programming will recommence in 2 weeks. For this episode, I'm just going to talk briefly about Record Store Day, 4 releases I got on Record Store Day that are jazz-related, and then briefly talk a little bit more about collecting jazz vinyl. So if you're really against the black stuff, this may be kind of boring. You can just skip it. I do think the music itself is of intrinsic interest, but the rest of the discussion may just be something that doesn't relate to you, and I apologize for that. We felt it was better to put out an episode of some kind rather than just take a break. So again, 2 weeks from now, 209's coming up. We'll be starting season 9. We're all looking forward to it. We think some good interviews are coming up. We've got a lot of good material lined up. But for now, talk briefly about Record Store Day and some releases I got there.
May I hear your new releases? I'm in the market for some brand new pieces. Let me read your record list. There may be something I don't want to miss. Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and the Dorseys. Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, they're the voices. King Cole and Johnny Mercer just won't stop jumping at the record shop.
So Record Store Day was invented as a way of promoting local independent record stores, which really are about the only kind of record stores left now. And the idea was we put limited editions, and I say we, they would put limited editions of records out, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. And that would encourage collectors to come out on a certain day of the year or days of the year, visit the record stores in person and pick these records up, hopefully picking up some other things on the way. Of course, like many things to do with limited releases, what that turned into was kind of a certain number of people going out and scooping things up to eBay later, and kind of a enforced scarcity that doesn't make a lot of sense when you're talking about art, and a certain focus on novelty efforts that may be worth the most intrinsically worthwhile. But certainly there are interesting things you can get there. The event is largely focused on, I'd say, rock and punk, certain kinds of popular music. I don't know that there are, for instance, many country-oriented Record Store Day releases. I think there's some R&B and soul and rap ones, but an awful lot seem to be about kinds of things aged at the 50-plus white record collector, let's say. And, of course, out in the margins, there's some jazz. No classical whatsoever. It just does not happen. That's just a little too niche. So anyway, your opinion of this is going to depend on kind of how you think about these concocted events, how you feel about going into crowds, even pre-COVID or post-COVID, and shopping, how much you like this idea of these novelty limited print runs. I think I tried once or maybe twice to actually go to Record Store Day on Record Store Day. I've largely given that up. I might drop by, you know, within a week or two of the drop. And often, some or all of the jazz releases remain in stock at the local record stores. It kind of depends. I certainly don't let the limited nature of a release drive me. I think that, you know, if you want to pick something up, pick it on its merits, not the fact it might go out of print. I would say that generally the kinds of releases they tend to focus on, especially in the jazz field, are obscurities, live shots that haven't been put on vinyl yet, and some old favorites that they've kind of repackaged or put on colored vinyl or something. But a lot of them are kind of more on the corners of the jazz catalog. It's not like you're going to get kind of Blue and Giant Steps on a Record Store Day, right? It's the more obscure stuff.
You sang me your song of remorse. Forgive me if I answered coldly, but just like a broken record, you've been repeating the lies that you've told me. You swore it was only a kiss, that you didn't do it on purpose. But just like a broken record, your little story's only scratching the surface.
The other thing to say about it, and I'll talk about this a little bit more length at the end of the episode, is that Record Store Day is not necessarily focused on sound quality in vinyl per se. It's more about the novelty, the rarity, the excitement around a limited run of something than it is about this is the best possible sounding release of a given work. And that partially has to do with the obscurity. A couple of the ones I'm talking about are air shots. They were not professionally recorded. So, you know, there's nothing you could do to make them sound like a hi-fi spectacular. Part of it has to do with the audience. I think the audience is certainly a certain percentage of it is collectors, some of whom might not even own turntables. They aren't necessarily audiophiles. I don't think this means the event has no value, but if you're going in there to look for the best the LP can offer, just in terms of sound, it's probably not the place to go. I certainly don't know how many, if any, of these releases are AAA or all analog. I think a lot of them are dubs of digital sources. I think some dub digital sources can sound great both digitally and on LP. I'm not doctrinaire about that, but you know, again, if you're looking for the purest form of the vinyl art, you're probably better off looking elsewhere. So all that said, over the last year, Record Store Day was scattered into three events because, of course, they did not want large crowds coming to Record Store Days due to COVID. So they tried to kind of space out the releases rather than having one or two major days. The jazz pickings were relatively slim. There were some big names, you know, Bill Evans, Sonny Rollins. Resonance Records is a ongoing participant in these RSD events. I think they're good sounding releases. They do a lot of work with the booklets and the supporting art and all that. The packaging, sometimes the material is not always as exciting as the packaging is. I'm not sure that any of the releases are necessarily all analog, but you know they make a pretty good product. I didn't pick any of theirs up. I think the couple of releases that came out of that label this year, I might later scoop them up on CD where they cost maybe a third as much, get the material and read the book, but not necessarily invest in the vinyl. So those were probably the biggest names. The releases I got, of them, two are, I'd say at the, really three are all associated with avant-garde or avant-garde adjacent players, and then one is kind of a novelty. So the ones I picked up were Don Cherry's Cherry Jam, Marion Brown's Porto Novo, and Jimmy Giuffre's 3 and 4, the New York Concerts. And then the novelty was Jazz Sabbath, and I'll talk about that last. It's a jazz piano trio playing the music of, you guessed it, Black Sabbath. The lightest of these releases is a four-track EP by Don Cherry. It's a live air shot, and I think it's also, because it's so short, it's an LP, but it's like 20 minutes long, they decided to release it as a 45 RPM LP. And, you know, some fancy releases will do this as a way of improving fidelity, and I've got a few releases of, like, Miles Davis's Second Great Quartet on 45 RPM. 40 minutes on two LPs are more expensive. The idea is you're getting more data going past the needle because the record is spinning faster, so the fidelity goes up a little bit. And certainly a couple of the ones I've gotten do sound fantastic. This Don Cherry release is an air shot. The only reason to do it is there's no reason not to. Most people don't play 10-inch records, so why not make it a 12-incher and just up the rotations per minute, because it can't hurt. I don't know that it would have sounded any worse if you put it on one side of an LP, frankly. Again, this is not a real high-quality recording, though by no means bad. It's not hissy. It's not blurty. It's just, you know, a so-so air shot. So Don Cherry, of course, is best known for his time with Ornette Coleman, and then his later solo work and championship of international music, world music. What this release reminds you of, basically, is that Cherry, before all that, was kind of coming out of the bebop tradition. He's never been a fleet, fluid, technically impressive bebop trumpeter like a Freddie Hubbard or a Donald Byrd. But, you know, his roots in a way in that music run a little deeper than Ornette Coleman, say. And this release, this four-track release, really shows that. So it's interesting from the point of view of you get to hear Don playing more or less bebop in a different context with a decent local pickup group. This is released on Gearbox. I would not put it in the same rank as some of the live air shots that have come out, like from the Café Montmartre. I mean, those are just stronger. They're better personnel. They're lengthier. They're more interesting. This is with a pickup group that includes Cherry on trumpet, Mogens Bullrup, tenor saxophone, Attili Bjorn, piano, and Benny Nielsen, bass, Simon Koppel, drums. So it's a quintet. I can't say the piano plays a large role, but it's there. As is the case with many air shots and live recordings, the focus of the sound is largely on the front line. You do get to hear some of the bass soloing. So this is a pickup group recorded in Copenhagen, and it's what you might expect. You know, it's a group that gets along pretty well, does not have fantastic chemistry. I'd say our tenor player is certainly competent. He's not a world beater. The selections, a couple of them are kind of hummable, and I feel like when I listen to The Ambassador from Greenland, I feel like, do I know that tune somehow? I don't know that I do, but it's got a very familiar-sounding bop line to it that seems like it's based on a tune that I know, a jazz tune, not a standard. They play You Took Advantage of Me. Which, of course, is really looking back. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you cannot imagine Ornette Coleman ever getting close to. They do Nigeria, and then a song called Priceless, an original I really don't know the origins of. For me, the interest lies in hearing Cherry in this much more straight-ahead context, the novelty of hearing with this particular pickup group. And, I really enjoy Don Cherry. This is not my first, third, or fifth choice of where I want to listen to him. But, you know, as a novelty, it's an interesting thing to pick up. It certainly tells us a little bit more about him as, you know, as a bebop player going into the avant-garde, as opposed to somebody, you know, purely centered in the avant-garde. And I think it's an enjoyable enough performance. It's not super stressful. It's not super demanding. You can certainly put it on in the background, and it's rough and ragged, but it's not unlistenable. It's not too noisy. It's, you know, and you can enjoy it. If you saw this in digital form, would you be losing something? I think absolutely not. I don't think this is some kind of display of the beauty that LPs can bring to sound reproduction, let's face it. But, you know, it's an enjoyable little release, does no harm, and for me at least, kind of reminded me of Don Cherry, the bebop player. So the next album I want to talk about is Marion Brown's Porto Novo, and this is the one that I'd say of the releases I got is the major work. It's probably one of this alto saxophone player Marion Brown's greatest albums. There's a lot of interest on it. It's a jazz trio, and there's a little bit of conflict there in that a bassist named Martin von Regedeben Altena, and I apologize, Martin, who is, you know, he does some bowing, he's interventionist, you know, he's in that Richard Dale, in that Richard Davis bag to some degree. I'm not saying he's as great as Richard Davis, but, you know, in that kind of language you hear being deployed. And then Han Bennick, the wildly unpredictable, humorous, charismatic drummer, is also on the date. So it's a trio. And to some degree, like Don Cherry, I mean, this is a player who is not necessarily directly associated with Ornette Coleman, but is of the avant-garde branches of the time, clearly more in that school than the energy school, the spiritualist school of, say, a John Coltrane or an Albert Ayler, right? He's more about those, you know, playing phrases as opposed to energy sheets. He's a direct player, an earthy player. He's probably a little bit more interested in the altissimo and squealing than, say, an Ornette Coleman would be. I don't think he's as brilliant a player as Ornette can be on alto, but he's characterful, and, you know, there's a kind of songness to some of it. You know, there are some melodies. There is, because of the clarity of the trio setting, there is a sort of kind of orderliness to it, despite the fact it's pretty avant-garde. There are different ideas across the track, so I think it's a pretty well-balanced album. You don't feel like it's all about one groove repeated five or six times. The different songs create slightly different moods. It was released on Record Store Day on colored vinyl, for what that's worth, and I don't know. I think colored vinyl is a lot of fun. I don't really necessarily think it harms the sound, but of course it doesn't improve it. And in terms of sound, what I'd say is that some of it is stunning and some of it is problematic. The presentation of Marion Brown, it puts him in the room. It's detailed, it's vibrant. You can really hear the nuances of his playing. It's very immediate. And it, you know, some of it is somewhat abrasive. If you don't like avant-garde sax, stay away. I mean, this is not, you know, easy listening by any stretch. This is out. Though, again, in that Ornette school, it's not pure energy or pure atonality where there's nothing to hold on to. So he's really done well by the engineer. The bass player certainly has moments. And Bennick is the one that sometimes, you know, there's periods where he's on kind of bongos or congos or something. And he's right there burbling in the speakers. But when all three of them are playing and he's in the background pounding away, sometimes the distortion gets very intense and it sounds like he's playing more or less on amplified cardboard. And it just kind of collapses for him, the sound. The engineer was not up to capturing him in full flight with the other horn, the horn and the bass. Just couldn't pull that trick off. There are moments where Han is great. There are moments with the whole group where he just sounds very rough. So just to be prepared for that, you know, this is, I've said before, I'll say again, you know, for me, avant-garde music in a way almost demands better fidelity of reproduction than anything else because so much of it's about texture. You really can't predict what's going on. There's nothing in the back of your head telling you what's supposed to be happening next, kind of filling in the gaps as there would be in a more traditional performance. So you really need to hear clearly, and a certain amount of it is just about the production of sound at this point. It's not about the logic of melody and harmony. It's just about the textures being produced at the time, their intensity, their variance, you know. So when that's interfered with, I think it's harder to enjoy avant-garde music. And for me, you know, it's not my favorite kind anyway. It's not something I listen to every day. It's something I'm very conscious that if I'm playing it at volume with other people in the room or in the house, I'm kind of being a bit of an asshole, right? Most people don't like it. So it's a little bit of a social pressure not to kind of play it all the time, even if I wanted to, because, you know, most people don't get this stuff or like this stuff. So I strongly recommend listening to it. Again, do I think that something special was brought to the table by having it on vinyl? Not necessarily. It's a pretty release. I do want to come out and say, from time to time, I've had a couple questionable Record Store Day releases. I got a Curtis Fuller album I loved to death on Savoy years ago. The pressing's just a mess. But I think quality control in general seems to be going up, and certainly in the ones I got this year, in terms of just being flat, in terms of being relatively noiseless, these are good pressings. They aren't the height of, you know, what LP art can be. I don't know that any of them are all analog. I don't, you know, but they're well done. They aren't just defective. They aren't just rough. And it was certainly true of this one. And it's pretty and colorful and all the rest of it. So I don't listen to this record a lot. I'm not likely to, but I'd say of the ones I got, this is the most important release and the most aesthetically satisfying. It's got something to say. If you want to ask yourself, you know, why is Marion Brown an important saxophone player? You know, I've not gotten Afternoon of a Georgia Fawn. I can't remember if that was the first ECM release or just an early one, but definitely want to hear that now, especially having looked at the personnel, much bigger project. Marion himself, I've got a couple recordings by him. I like him. You know, I kind of associate him with like Prince Lasha or Sonny Simmons or, you know, there's a number of players out there, often more on alto and flute, and this guy just plays alto on this recording, but then, say, tenor, who do seem to kind of spring out of the Ornette Coleman school that are more into that. And of my preference, I kind of like that school better than energy music, so I enjoyed this project. Again, I don't think you have to get it on Record Store Day, but it's one to look out for. Now, the one I learned probably the most from or was most surprised by was a Jimmy Giuffre 3 and 4 New York concerts. This is a double LP, and it earns, you know, it needs that much vinyl to get the music across. Of two concerts that he performed, one with a group comprised of three players and fill in the blanks, kids, the other one had a group of four. I've known about Jimmy for a while. He enters probably jazz history as one of the four brothers in Woody Herman's band, and then he goes on to a much more kind of avant-garde career. For a long time, he has a trio, and I've got a series of, I got like a four-disc set of his groups with Jim Hall. He plays a lot of clarinet. He's a fairly dry musician, both in the terms of way he's recorded with, you know, a little reverb often, and also just the way he plays. Not vibrato, not the most immediately melodic guy, but a very thoughtful player. And certainly the stuff he did with Jim Hall is largely, I think, it's of the cool school without being in it. And it's kind of moving towards an abstraction through omission. You know, that it's He tends to have very light textured groups, and he tends to avoid piano. Well, that's not always true. I guess he's a trio with Paul Blay, who's kind of an exception to the rule anyway, and Steve Swallow, where there's piano involved, but they're all playing very minimalistically. That's kind of where he goes next in his recorded legacy, with a trio there that is much more out than the group with Jim Hall. And this documents a long fallow period in the studios for Jimmy, where he puts on a couple live concerts, and what's striking about them is they are avant-garde. They are out. In a way that the other recordings by Jimmy that I've heard are not as committed to kind of in-your-face, atonal, challenging music. So the personnel, Jimmy Giuffre on tenor sax and clarinet, and that's another striking thing about this recording, is that he's playing tenor, as well as his best-known instrument, clarinet. Joe Chambers, the great drummer, is on drums. On disc one, Richard Davis on bass. So you can see right there, this is a seriously talented group, right? You know, the trio group. Joe Chambers, Richard Davis, and Jimmy Giuffre. That's not bad pickings. And then on the second disc, it's a quartet. Giuffre, Chambers, and then Barr Phillips on bass. Don Friedman on piano. And there's at least a couple songs that he plays on both of these concerts. So you can, at least three, I guess. So you can compare them, though. None of them are hummable. And a lot of them are, from my taking, pretty chalky, pretty dry, pretty challenging out recordings. They are not smiley face, cuddly out recordings. They are serious, searching, uncompromising music. And, it was a little bit of a shocker to hear how far out he goes on this. These were recorded by a gentleman. I'm trying to look here. What's the label here? So it's released on Elemental Records. They are not the same as Resonance Records, but I feel like there's an A&R man to kick together something. There's that feeling, the packaging. There's an echo with Resonance Records. It's another kind of, maybe it doesn't have a huge book with it the way those do, but it's another kind of event packaging of what are ultimately air shots or local recordings of a couple concerts. And I think it's worthy of an event. I mean, I don't think this is just repackaging something that is of lower quality that you're trying to do it all with a publicity or all with a wrapping. But it's fairly challenging. So, you know, I guess my thought having listened to this is that, one, it's a pretty decent audio document. I mean, it's not as pretty as many studio recordings, but it certainly works. You know, you can hear what's going on. It's not grating. It's not so distorted. It fatigues you. I'd say that it's impressive to me and that it is so uncompromising, but I wasn't sure at any one moment while listening to it if I was having fun or not. I'd say that Jimmy, as an improviser in this mode, Tans, it's not so much that he's atonal, that he is very experimental and almost seemingly willfully avoiding melody, willfully avoiding pattern, willfully avoiding anything that might accidentally please the ear. And while I respect that kind of avant-garde atonal playing, I don't necessarily warm to it or enjoy it that much. I know it's possible to play that way, and I respect people who are willing to have the discipline to do so. I'm just not certain that I find it that rewarding. It doesn't sound so much like freedom as discipline to me in a certain way. It's like, what's the point of taking away all the rules if you can't have fun, you know? Okay, there's no law left. Everybody be an anarchist and study for the test. Yeah, I don't know that I find this a recording I'm going to return to a lot. I have listened quite a bit to Free Fall, and I can't remember the name of the other one that was re-released on ECM. I might have gotten those on Owl, I'm not sure. The trio with Blay and Swallow. I've listened a fair amount to his earlier group with the Jim Hall, and those are all pleasant. I mean, it's not the kind of thing I could listen to disc after disc. I mean, he is just, another way of putting it is that he doesn't exactly, obviously there's a personality, there's a will there, but he's not a charismatic or personality-filled player. The way, you know, when Sonny Rollins goes out as far as Sonny goes, the sunniness of it all is just always vividly there. You cannot escape the sunniosity. It's all about Sonny, Sonny being Sonny, just Sonny going out. And this is almost more like Jimmy's got his white coat on and he's experimenting in the lab and what are the results going to be, rather than looking at it as someone who's either expressing an ego or a self or breaking certain rules to have a little bit more fun with the ones that remain. So, you know, again, I love these musicians. There are moments of great beauty on these recordings. Again, I'm just kind of gobsmacked by the freedom. I keep going back to uncompromising, the willingness to kind of give concerts with this kind of music, this unassuming Texan that's really, you know, putting you on notice and really demanding that you kind of accept it at its own rules, that you don't come into it thinking it's going to try to please or entertain you. And it's, you know, it's not wild energy music either, but it's so far removed from the blues and so willing to kind of go into just tone production questions or just sheer lines that their sole existence seems to be not ever satisfying the ear, not ever not surprising you. That, you know, it's a ways away from even Ornette Coleman, even though, again, the airiness of the groups and the fact that he's not doing anything like Sheets of Sound or not doing anything incantatory or modal or anything. It's a long way still from it. It's kind of a third stream, as one might say. And, of course, he's known somewhat for kind of pushing that way, a kind of a chamber jazz is a way of talking about it. Another way you could say is, you know, jazz with a fair mix of Caucasian aesthetics in it. Which, you know, I'm not trying to be essentialist here. I know that's a made-up term and a made-up category. But, you know, just sort of those strains we tend to clichédly associate with white people. So, yeah, definitely something you should stream or try to listen to if you have interest in the left-leaning jazz or in Jimmy Giuffre, or just wanted to find out what weird shit he was pulling off when he got out of Woody Herman's band and how strange things got, how far he got from Four Brothers. Very, very far. You know, a couple people, you know, Bob Brookmeyer, to some degree, who was very much, and for a longer period of time, kind of a mainstream and even swing-facing valve trombonist, and we've talked about his music before on the show. You know, he kind of ends up being an almost atonal, very out arranger later in his life, in a way that was kind of hard to expect this veer coming. And you know, in a very different way, Giuffre does the same thing. So probably in a way the most striking or historically important new discovery of the selections I listened to, I'd still say that Marion Brown's is the most aesthetically important and the one you probably want to listen to first. So finally, talk briefly about Jazz Sabbath. You know, this release, which came out in vinyl. I did not pick it up on vinyl. I got it as a download, a kind of a high bit rate download, and I think that was the way to go for me personally. It might be fun on vinyl. Came with a whole made-up backstory that there was this jazz group named Jazz Sabbath, and that Black Sabbath stole their tunes back in the 70s. You know, it was kind of a mockumentary-style thing. I've not seen it. Maybe someday I will. I'm not that concerned with it. It's a jazz trio covering Black Sabbath songs. And each of the players in the trio is given a kind of a stage name or a made-up name. But the actual players are Adam Wakeman on piano, and he had toured with Black Sabbath and now tours with Ozzy Osbourne, apparently. Jerry Meehan on upright bass. Ash Sohn on drums. And it's a perfectly competent jazz piano trio. The problem for me is I've only listened to Paranoid, from which many of these songs were taken, a handful of times. And I've never gotten deeply into Black Sabbath. I, most importantly, did not grow up with them. So they aren't embedded in my consciousness the way that for many kids who listen to them at 12, 13, 14, you know, they're just part of the DNA. They're part of the history. They're part of your discovery of music. As a young kid, I just was not in the emotional space where I wanted anything to do with heavy metal. I got a lot more... in terms of avant-garde music and heavy metal and noise music and the retro, I was much easier to deal with that at 30 than I was at 10. I just was wired funny. So Black Sabbath was not part of my upbringing. You know, it may be that the friend who got a box full of records that I learned about a lot of groups from didn't happen to have a Black Sabbath record in there. Maybe if they had, I would have learned about them. I don't know. So while I enjoy this, and I have heard Paranoid a few times, the joke of it, of turning Iron Man or Fairies Wear Boots into jazz is a little lost on me. Because I'm not saying, oh, they did that to that kind of thing. You know, in a weird way, it reminds me there's a jazz piano trio from England that covered King Crimson tunes. And in a weird way, even though I think those groups are very, very different, when you hear them jazzed up by British piano players, they sound a lot more alike than you would think. So that's kind of an odd thing. I think the one thing that kind of filled me with relief on having not bought this, and I got to admit, none of these, if I probably only listened to these releases because they were released on vinyl, which is a sad, sorry thing to say. And not that I do listen. But there, I guess what I'm saying is the oddities that they were, the novelty of getting them on vinyl might have encouraged me to get them. Whereas there's a hell of a lot of things I'd rather listen to on CD first. So anyway, I was relieved that I got this one at least as a download because while it's fun and it's pleasant, you know, the piano player, he's kind of rhythmically stiff. He's finally not in the front rank of a great jazz pianist. He's okay, but there's just a little awkwardness there and a little lack of facility. Not saying he's a bad piano player by any stretch. He's just not in the top rank. Brad Meldo is not scared. Keith Jarrett can still play better than him, and Keith retired. So, you know, it's just, you know, it's fine, but it's more about the good humorness of it and the humor. It's not just a joke. It's not like they don't mean it or they're just, it's some kind of parody. I wouldn't want to say that. It's humorous in the serious sense of they're playing this music with love and with humor. Not again jokey, not a parody, not a one-off, but not a gag. But, you know, it's a humorous recording, and that the joke is the deep humor about it is that they're covering these tunes that we don't think of as being jazzy. And I will say, you know, listening to Iron Man as a piano trio, and then I queued up the Black Sabbath, it's like, okay, I can hear these little melodic bits, but boy, they really do. They're not afraid to really turn this stuff into jazz. This is not a half-assed effort where they're trying to imitate heavy metal with an acoustic piano trio. They are turning heavy metal songs, which do have a little more complexity and more parts than you might think from Black Sabbath's reputation, into actual jazz. And I think part of the thing with Black Sabbath is that, you know, they are musically interesting to some degree, the downtuned guitar and everything. It's just that Ozzy Osbourne's lyrics, or whoever writes the lyrics, are just so remarkably dumb that you kind of then project that onto the music itself. I mean, Iron Man, it's like it was written by a fairly intelligent fifth grader. I mean, it's just, he's just not a verbally, I mean, he expresses what he's trying to say, but he's not very verbally gifted. And the concept is kind of crayon deep. And so you hear that, and when you're hearing the lyrics, you aren't thinking sophisticated music, you're thinking, you know, it makes it sound dumber than it is. And so, you know, this trio shows that, in fact, you know, there's no reason you cannot play those tunes as jazz tunes. I mean, they work perfectly well. I think they'd be even more fun to hear by a top-flight pianist. But, you know, they're fine. And the rest of the group is fine. I mean, it's no harm is done. They're all good musicians. I mean, I never felt like, oh, these guys shouldn't have recorded. This shouldn't have been released. You know, not at all. But they're not top-rank jazz musicians. I mean, just certainly not the piano player who's the one I kind of focus the most on. But that doesn't mean it's not fun. I mean, one or two tunes almost kind of turn into a easy listening's not quite the right phrase, but they didn't quite have the energy or focus of the rest. And then it was kind of like, well, this is just almost elevator-esque. I don't quite get the point. I'm not having that much fun anymore. But I'd say this one or two tunes out of the seven. So yeah, it's a seven-track album. I think mostly it's pretty successful. I'd say that Children of the Grey, the last tune, is maybe veering a little bit towards easy listening. But overall, you know, it's a fun slab of music. It is not earth-shaking. I think I would enjoy it a little bit more if I enjoyed and knew Black Sabbath a little bit better. But fun. And I am a huge fan of covering music other than jazz standards or, you know, standards from the 30s and 40s in jazz form. I think that jazz should continue to try to interact with popular culture. And God knows, I mean, these, you know, these tunes are almost 50 years old. So they are by no means, you know, new pop music. They're something that really is in the kind of Midwestern canon, which is, you know, Midwestern classical music is classic rock. That's just the way it works. Our Beethoven is REO Speedwagon. Why not engage with that stuff? Because there is a critical mass of people who might sit down and listen to a jazz trio who know it. So I think that's a great idea. You know, this is not necessarily the most awe-inspiring example of doing that I've ever seen or heard, but it's certainly a project that I wholeheartedly like. So those are my thoughts on four Record Store Day releases. There are certainly other interesting jazz releases out there. I tended towards the obscure. In a way, I feel like I am, you know, if it's a Sonny Rollins release or whatever, I am more likely to get it in one form or another and was, you know, less interested. And of course, the other thing is it's more likely, practically speaking, to be sold out when I go to the record store one or two weeks after the event's over, poke around and see if there's anything left that I might pick up. Because I can't be bothered to get up early on a Saturday morning and go down there with a bunch of other people, especially in COVID times, but really any time. It's just not worth it to me. And it might be to you, and I'm not trying to judge you if it is, but for me, I'm not going to do that. We'll be right back. So quickly, just a couple thoughts. You know, if you are interested in jazz and vinyl, where to start? I'd say Record Store Day is probably not the place. So before I get started, just a couple quick thoughts about vinyl in general. The last few years have seen a huge resurgence in vinyl issues, in part because otherwise physical media for music has more or less disappeared. Streaming has replaced CDs and other digital forms for most people, including downloads. And so if you want an object to kind of fetishize or to make sure that some money goes to the artist that you love, more and more people are kind of defaulting to vinyl, in some cases even when they don't own a turntable. First thing, vinyl is a physical medium, obviously in a certain way a compact disc is, but really it's just a data conveyance device that happened to be round, that can really be any shape. More often now we talk about files. Unless you've got a terrible printing plant, it's going to come out pretty much identical every time. Vinyl things go wrong. You're physically pressing a little biscuit of plastic into a shape that has very, very delicate grooves. So you're always, the risk-reward is a stronger formula there. I think the best vinyl sounds really incredible, but things can go wrong. So if you want to be safe, you're probably better off streaming or buying a CD or a download. There's been a big debate in vinyl about whether or not vinyl should be cut all analog or from digital files. Back in the day, obviously, all recordings were all analog. First, they were acoustic. Then later on, recordings were made to tape, which was much more easily manipulated. And then, of course, eventually, we started recording things digitally. Even recordings made from the so-called master tape, often what's happened is the master tape was first converted to a digital file, and then the digital file was used to actually cut the LP for various mechanical and conservation reasons. Sometimes the tape itself is very delicate. So I think the most important thing with any recording is how well was it mastered and recorded in the first place. A good dub of a digital tape can sound fantastic. Certainly some of the pop albums I've gotten recently, reissues of Kate Bush and Brian Eno, I've heard things on those reissues I've never heard before. I think they're fantastic mastering jobs. I'm pretty confident both of those were made from digital files, not directly from master tapes. Would it be more efficient to buy them as a download? Probably so, but you know, the format sounds good and my playback equipment's better for vinyl. So, you know, your choice on that. But I don't think that should be your first concern. That said, generally, the consensus is that if you can get something that's all analog, there's going to be a little more immediacy to it. There's just fewer steps between the performance and you're hearing the performance. And so generally, that's a preferred method if you can get it, and it's well done. And certainly there's been a lot of LPs since this interest in vinyl exploded that were just simply sloppy dubs from a CD. They don't have any particular, they might have a neat cover, they might be collectible in that sense, but they don't sound better than necessarily, they typically sound worse than a CD would. One thing to look out for if you're buying jazz, new jazz vinyl reissues, if it's got a large rectangular sticker on it in the front that says 180 gram vinyl, it's probably from a European pressing house, and it's probably a dub of a CD. It might sound okay. I've gotten a couple of those, and they really don't sound bad, but they're not going to be as carefully mastered as the ones from the well-known reissue houses. So just something to think about. There's also kind of an obsession with weight. You know, I mentioned that 180-gram sticker. What does that mean? It means if you take a piece of vinyl out of the cover and put it on a digital scale, it's supposed to read around 180. Once or twice when I was feeling especially bored, I've done this, and boy, the numbers are all over the place. So they don't mean exactly 180. Sometimes they weigh more, sometimes a little bit less. The theory is thicker vinyl is less likely to warp, and if you have extremely thin vinyl, you might have difficulty with depth of groove and that sort of thing. In general, most records were not made on 180 gram back in the day. Many of them sound fantastic. New issues that are on like 140 gram vinyl are often just fine. So, you know, again, that weight is probably the least. It's easily measured. You can make a number out of it, and I think that's the appeal of it. This weighs so many grams. It's a fact. It's probably the least important thing as to how the reissue would sound. Finally, I'd say whatever format you're listening to, if it sounds good to you, it is good. I mean, you are the final arbiter of what you like in music, how you like it. You may find your taste changing and developing over time, or you may not, but whatever you do, if you're enjoying the music, you've won, and don't let anybody tell you differently. So, you know, I've really gotten into this adventure in the last 10, 15 years, but, you know, music, you don't have to be thinking about sound quality to enjoy it or understand it. It's another aspect of it. It does add depth to my pleasure, but if it doesn't to yours, that is A-OK. right now we are in a renaissance of great quality jazz issues, narrowly focused, but there are some great examples available. Some European labels have been, you know, Analog Seduction, Pure Pleasure, whatever. And American labels, you know, the Acoustic Sounds label, have been releasing high quality, typically all analog releases of certain jazz albums and, of course, other pop albums and other genres of music for quite a while. These tend to be pricey, but they tend to be, you know, the quality control is immaculate typically, and the sound is typically very, very good. Now that's been moving a little bit more into the popular domain, the most notorious offender in that regard being Blue Note. For the last couple of years, Blue Note has just gone crazy with releasing all analog, meticulously mastered LPs of their classic catalog. I've talked in print before about what a disaster their 75th anniversary vinyl initiative was. These were digital dubs on badly pressed vinyl. Some were just too noisy to really put up with. They were mediocre sounding. And then Don Was apparently had a moment in Damascus, saw the light, and said, "No, we need all analog stuff." And so he contacted this guy named Joe Harley, and they started the Tone Poet series. And, you know, $35 gatefold releases of all analog oddities in the Blue Note catalog largely. A lot of those you could get cheaper if you looked around for sales, either on Amazon or Blue Note themselves. Then they introduced the Blue Note 80th series, which were, again, some lesser-known items from the Blue Note catalog. These were done up as $25 releases. The covers weren't as fancy. The liners were often pure paper, but otherwise they're pretty much close to the Tone Poet. They're all analog, 180-gram pressings. They sound fantastic as well. A plastic liner is not very expensive. You can afford it. And those would sometimes go on sale for $20, or, you know, every now and then Blue Note would have a 30% off sale. And then this year they started the Classic Initiative, which is going back to the really well-known items from their catalog and releasing those as all analog, 180, you know. So yeah, at the rate of about two a month. So, I mean, Blue Note's going crazy with this stuff. Get them while they're hot. If you want to put that kind of money into new vinyl, you certainly, for Blue Note releases, classic ones, you're not going to pick something up used without dropping serious lettuce. They've been, you know, collector's items for too many decades. Too many people hoard them. They're very hard to find. And I've been enjoying those immensely. I think they sound fantastic. Of course, you have to, you know, I mean, they vividly illustrate, and much more dramatically than the CDs, Rudy Van Gelder's strengths and weaknesses. So, you know, the vividness of the horns is unparalleled. Sometimes the rest gets lost a bit. But those are great. Verve is now doing a series. A Love Supreme, you know, beautiful pressing of that album. I really enjoyed Ballads by Coltrane. You know, I just feel like that album doesn't have quite the spark that it might have. But it's fine. And then there's a couple of Nina Simones out there. For some reason, they're doing George Russell's New York, New York that has narration by John Hendricks. It's like my least favorite of his classic period. I love George Russell. Don't think that was the right choice. You know, they picked Stan Getz's Bossa Nova classic. They put one of those out. There's, you know, it's much more limited and it's much more hesitant, I'd say, and extremely conservative in what they're picking when it's not just downright odd. And they tend to seem to be hovering around the $35 mark. But those are good. And then, you know, I personally am getting into 70s CTI and ECM. Very, very different labels. And the thing is, once you start going into the 70s, if that aesthetic doesn't bother you, there's a lot of used vinyl out there that sounds really, really good and is fairly cheap. And just other labels, you know, Inner City, there's a lot of jazz on, you know, used records that, you know, not all of it, but much of it is in very good shape physically, sounds good. And of course, you know, everything from the 70s, unless it's been reissued, is all analog. Everything from the 60s is all, you know, they didn't have any digital. So, you know, that doesn't mean they all sound good. I mean, some of them sound like crap because, you know, there's nothing magic about having tubes or solid state and tape instead of digital that makes your record sound good. It's just that it has a possibility of sounding pretty fucking incredible. So there's a lot of stuff out there to look at. You know, if you want to get into Wynton Marsalis and decide, well, it would be more fun to put this on a turntable than on a CD player, it's there. I think these are probably mostly digital dubs. I don't know if they sound any better than the CDs, but just if that's your preferred media, they're all over the place. So there are certainly places you can pick up used vinyl that sometimes, you know, I would talk before on this podcast about the CTI release with Art Farmer, the Dave Matthews Big Band. I think it's a great record. I got it for $5. So there's stuff like that out there. Now, I mean, it's a little commercial sounding, but it's a pretty good record. Some of his other stuff, you know, some of the CTI sound is pretty compromised. You have to get into that weird, over-the-top aesthetic. I kind of am, in some cases, really liking it. Some of it, I realize, is crap. So it's, you know, whatever floats your boat. Cecil Taylor, you know, they reissued Silent Tongues, one of his classics on Arista, like last year in Record Store Day. You know, I picked up a near-mint copy of that. Used. I mean, it's Cecil Taylor. People don't like him. He's an avant-garde piano player that makes your ears hurt. So, you know, you can get the Record Store Day version of it, and maybe it sounds marginally better. I'm not sure that it does, but there are mint copies of that floating around anyway, because a lot of people bought it and they heard his name and said, holy crap, okay, this is not for me. Played it once, put it back. So, you know, if you're into avant-garde music, there's a lot of opportunities to get things that, you know, may be in pretty good shape. And I personally, I've gotten to love a lot, maybe it's because I'm getting older, of the first decade of ECM. Even some of the dreamier, fruitier stuff I quite like. And a lot of those sound very, very good. So anyway, alternatives to Record Store Day, if you're going to get into jazz vinyl, I'd say if you like the classic Blue Note sound and you think you might want to start playing records, this is the time to start looking around, because some of them are already falling out of print. And they may sound expensive, though, really, if you look historically at what music used to cost back when people paid for it, what CDs cost 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, and in the difficulty of making a good record as opposed to a good compact disc in terms of pressing, just creating the object, the prices are really pretty reasonable. Again, streaming is free, so, I mean, you don't have to pay for music ever again, especially if you're willing to put up with ads about Kroger. But should you want to, you know, that's up. So anyway, this concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 208.5. As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com. You can drop me a line on Facebook, look us up at All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, from Apple Podcasts, and it can be streamed on All About Jazz. So Mike and I are still kind of working out what's going to happen next. I think, and I don't want to swear to you people, that we're going to do a show on some 2020 Blue Note releases that we did not get to in the last year. So I think what we're going to talk about is the Blue Note Reimagined collection, Joel Ross's new release, The Vibraphone Players, Who Are You?, Artemis, the all-female supergroup on Blue Note, and Ron Miles' Rainbow Sign. Now, we might drop one of those if it's too much music for us to digest. Mike might decide he wants to do something completely different. I can't tell you until I talk to him. But till next time, take care.